Hello and welcome to another episode of the Foxhole Companion with me, Dan Stewart.
And me, Simon Rance.
So we're staying in North Africa, Simon.
We are indeed. More dusty pants.
More dusty, sandy pants. It's part of our Tobruk triple bill.
Mm.
Last week. It was about a year ago. last episode, listeners, we did the fabulous Czech film Tobruk.
Which was fabulous.
Which we really liked.
Yeah.
It was in our top five so far.
Absolutely.
And we've had a couple of loyal listeners write in on the Twitter sphere talking about how much they enjoyed it as well. A really lovely surprise. This podcast, we've got a rip-roaring surprise and a really unpleasant surprise.
Well, and it's essentially the Chips Rafferty double bill, isn't it?
Yeah.
Starting off with The Rats of Tobruk, made in 1944 and directed and written by Charles Chauvel.
Yeah, and then we're going to move on to the much better...
Yeah, Robert Wise's The Desert Rats.
Yeah. Just before we start, we would just like to say that we're dedicating this episode to John Anthony Rance, who very sadly passed away 2 weeks ago and was a listener, and not only a listener, but was Simon's dad.
Yep.
And we're thinking of him.
Thanks, mate.
This episode's for you, John. We're not going to spend too much time on The Rats of Tobruk.
Oh, come on, mate!
It is shocking, Simon, isn't it? I mean...
Oh, mate, it's... Oh, seriously.
Simon, while we were watching this, Simon did seem to think that this might be up there with Confessions of a Nazi Spy.
It's so bad. But the difference... Well, I don't know. It's the same with Confessions of a Nazi Spy. It has an amazing lead. You know, this film has Peter Finch as Peter Linton, who obviously is an incredible actor. But, you know, so Charles Chauvel, as I said... This was his, he'd already made a big-ish film called The 40,000 Horsemen in 1940. And this was his follow-up. And I just want to say something
was
about...
Was he Australian?
This. Yes, he was. He was, I believe he was from, from Queensland. And
that's Australia.
It is indeed. He was born in 1897 and he died in Sydney, Australia, age 62, in 1959. Very sad news, obviously, but I can't imagine the film industry cried itself to sleep, losing an auteur like him. This film is a debacle from start to finish. It's one of the worst edited, worst written, worst shot films I've ever seen in my life. It's also blatantly racist and sexist. It's a disgrace. And... You know how some films are just like, oh, there's, in the Metropolitan, whatever, Museum of blah, 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 there's an edition of this film because it's seen as a work of art. This should be put in the Tower of London.
And decapitated.
In the cells, and never to see light of day again. I can't believe, this shows how crap it is. This shows how crap it is, because... If it was watchable for the first 20 minutes, which it isn't, by the way, but we watched it for you, so you don't have to.
Yep.
If it was watchable for the first 20 minutes, the censorship board reviewing censorship of movies would have sat for it and gone, oh my God, this is such a racist film. We now have to ban it, or at least edit out the use of the W and M word, which George Wallace, who plays... supposedly comedic role of the Barber of Tobruk. He's one of the worst actors ever, who ever breathed. And
I mean, well, all right, calm down, Simon, calm down.
It's been a tough couple of weeks, mate.
Yeah, fair enough.
We should have started with the other one.
We should have done. You're all angry now.
I know.
We actually watched this film quite a long time ago, and just it just shows how painful an experience it was when you can hear in Simon's voice how raw he still is about having sat through it over a month ago.
It just feels, you know, there are, we don't get much time to do the things we love. We, you know, there's work, there's family. Oh, family we love, obviously. Edit. But you and me hanging out, having a beer and watching a
war,
you know, a war movie, that's what we love to do. And so when we're given a massive sack of sewage like this, it's a slap in the face.
Oh, well, we're not... Oh, okay, well, let's talk about it a little bit, I suppose. The Rats of Tobruk, made in 1944, you'd be very easily mistaken for thinking that this was made in 1932. The quality of the film, I mean... I know we were during the war, but we've already covered some films that were made during the war that
absolutely.
Were of such much better quality.
Well, but the thing is, they were probably paid for by, you know, I mean, subsidiaries and so on and so forth, being British propaganda and that. So there is an excuse that it.
I don't believe there is any excuse, because if this was a propaganda exercise to keep the morale up of the Allies, and specifically the Aussies, morale would have plummeted.
Well,
having
I mean
seen
that's it. I mean the only propaganda is to go out to the nearest chemist and buy yourself some sleeping pills.
Yeah. But the movie may just make you fall asleep. It's so bad you can't even really sleep.
Well,
you
know, because your blood is boiling.
Well, a quick synopsis. Oh God.
All right. I'll do three. I mean, you can do it in three sentences, can't you?
Well, no, I there are a couple of bits of this that I do want to pick out as being...
Love triangle, racism.
Awful. The, oh, my God. Yeah, you just mentioned that, and now I've remembered it. Oh, both of our films, in a very obvious way, start with Waltzing Matilda. Just in case you didn't know we were dealing with Aussies, Waltzing Matilda runs through both these films quite a lot, but none more so than in The Rats of Tobruk. It's like constantly playing in the background. And it sounds like it's being played on one of those old wind-up gramophones, and they've stuck an ancient microphone next to like that big speaker that comes out, and that's the sound they've used. It is crackly. It is so bad.
Yeah.
And it basically
terrible. Starts
with three Aussie lads. Drovers. I don't know what the hell they're called. They're
drovers. Yes, they're drovers.
They're drovers. They're like, it's cattle. They're like, and they're out in the outback. It's basically driving cattle and living the good life and wistfully talking about their lives. And you're bored already. You're like, God, I hope they die.
So those three geezers are called Bluey, who's the leader, and he's supposed to be this kind of stoic man's man, and just like...
And that's Grant Taylor.
Yeah, you don't get much out of him, all this. Then you've got Milo, who's played by Chips Rafferty, and then you've got Peter Linton, played by Peter Finch, who's the intellectual, obviously.
You know he's the intellectual because he quotes Shakespeare
all the time.
All the bloody time.
All the time.
Because he's not Australian, is he, Simon? He's a Brit, but he's come to Australia to seek inspiration.
Yes.
And as he says at one point, well, this is frightfully amusing. I came here for inspiration and now I've jolly well signed up.
Yeah.
Because they all join that, oh, God, but wait, before we get there. They're in the middle of the outback and they happen across a homestead, I guess you'd call it, in which a single young lady lives. Now, when you first see this, it is the worst painted backdrop of any. It literally looks like a cartoon house. And they're like, oh, yonder is the house of the girl that we love, because they all sort of fancy her. Why they fancy her is a mystery to me.
Okay, well, I mean, we can't go into that because that's personal choice, isn't it?
No, she's so appalling as an actress.
Oh, right, okay.
But what were you thinking? She is so horrible as an actress. I don't actually believe she is an actress. She must be somebody's sister or something, somebody's girlfriend, because... the first 20 minutes of the film...
You're talking about Mary, right?
Oh, who cares what her name is? The first 20 minutes of this film is Bluey.
Oh, no, Kate Carmody. That's who you're talking about, Kate. It's Kate Carmody.
If you say so.
Yeah, played by Pauline Garrick. Do you think the Garrick Theatre was named after her?
Something tells me not, Simon. So anyway, Bluey's really in love with her, but he thinks she doesn't like him. And her problem, which is sort of justifiable, is that she sees him once a year when he's droving past her gaff.
Yeah.
And she lives in the middle of nowhere. And so she's like, well, last time you were here, you ran away. And he's such an Aussie fella that he doesn't know. He doesn't have the words to tell her how he really feels. Sorry, Australia, but...
That was so bad.
No.
That was half two.
That's what it's like.
Half two in Broadway, that was.
That's exactly what it's like. It's the most like I might. Struth. Oh, don't. Oh.
It's
anyway,
terrible.
They finally, they somehow, in the middle of the outback, get the news at Kate's house that war has broken out, and they're delighted. And so, cut to North Africa. It's one of the most appalling jumps ever. And they're marching along with a bunch of other. It's the same sort of stereotype that we keep seeing, Simon, again and again, especially in these older films, which is basically, well, if they're Tommies, they're plucky, chirpy Cockneys.
Yeah.
If they're Aussies, they're plucky, chirpy Aussies. But what do they have in common, Simon?
They moan.
Oh, my God.
They moan a lot.
Oh, the moaning, it goes on and
to
on.
To be fair.
The war's only just started for them and they're like,
I'd moan
and moan.
I'd moan if I was stuck in Tobruk, I've got to say.
Well, I'd moan if I was stuck in Tobruk with them. I'd rather join the Nazis.
Oh my God. Edit. Right, can we just quickly talk about Milo, who is played by Chips Rafferty? Well, because Chips Rafferty, for some reason, is a really well-known Aussie film star.
Is he?
And I've no
tell us all about
well,
him.
I've no idea why. anyway, his real name is John William Pillbean Goffage.
I can't imagine why he changed it.
So you can see how he just came up with Chips Rafferty from that. How weird is that? He's an MBE. He was born on 26th of March, which is incidentally is the same birthday as mine.
Oh, happy birthday.
Yeah.
So he was made a member of the British Empire.
Well, yeah, he got...
Not for this performance, he wasn't.
No, absolutely not. Loads of commercials in Britain. Australian feature films, as well as appearing in British and American productions.
All right, can we remember how this goes? Because
he also died in Sydney, just like... Charles the director.
Well, it's a nice place to die if you're going to die. It's very lovely down there.
Listen to this!
Expensive.
Listen to this! Oh,
go on.
I can't be taking a mickey out of stuff like this. My dad's just died. But anyway, maybe I can because my dad has just died.
Yeah, it's fair
so
enough.
So his resting place, Ashes. Can I read this in an Aussie accent?
Go on then.
I was born in New Zealand, which
fair
makes
enough.
It even worse.
Yeah, that's really insulting.
Ashes cast into his favourite fishing hole in Lovett Bay, Pittwater.
That's amazing.
A hole? Yeah, thrown in a hole.
But a fishing hole.
But
the fishing holes are like in the Arctic and things,
well,
aren't they?
It was his favourite one. I don't know where Lovett Bay is, do you?
I bet I don't love it. Whee!
Terrible.
Anyway. They moan all over North Africa. They moan and moan and then they sit and they get bombed and they moan. This film has... a huge amount of what the film claims is actual footage. I don't think it is, because it's pretty bland. And again, nothing really happens. Am I right in remembering, because I don't have this in my notes, but does Peter Finch die?
Yeah.
He does, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
How does
he
die?
He's shot, isn't he? He's shot, and he dies of an injury in their kind of temporary infirmary. And Bluey and Milo are like...
That's right, they're
oh
there.
Oh, my God. Oh,
he's gone.
I can't believe he's gone. But
Does he have some Shakespearean quote right before he goes? He probably does, doesn't he? Because this guy had a Shakespeare quote for everything. highlights of this was they're all facing death and they have a bit of a church service, which actually also happens in the Desert Rats as well. They're having a church service and the priest, rather than giving like a homily or a sermon, he just says, "No man is to yield 1 yard." Mm. Well, he wasn't. He was in the back, in the rear.
Well, so, you know, a job like that protects you from the front, doesn't it?
Another quote. I don't remember who said this, but I'm assuming it was the voiceover, the terrible voiceover that went with it. And the quote was, "The enemy was near, but so was God."
Deep.
God was not near the making of this film because he would not have allowed it.
No. So the highlight for me of this film, and is also the best death award, is when Chips Rafferty finally gets killed.
Oh, my word. This is great. This is great. And the reason this is great, and here's us laughing at this poor fella's demise, but the reason this is great is the last half hour of the film, weirdly, is not in North Africa at all.
No.
Because poor old...
Don't they go to Burma?
This is it.
Yeah.
So poor old Milo and Bluey... having beaten the Nazis single-handedly, the narrator tells us that the war was not over for these heroes, and we next see them wading through the sort of rice paddies of Burma or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And they're having a horrible time, and poor old...
Oh, no, but they stop because they see a waterfall, don't they?
That's it. Milo sees a waterfall, and he's gazing at this... Which now it looks like we're in the sort of tourist board of Burma. It's like, because it really is a big waterfall, whereas everything else in this is like a horrible set with wobbly walls and terrible painted bits. He goes, "Oh, Struth, I've never seen something so beautiful in all my days. To think that..."
Now, doesn't he say something about heaven?
To think that such heaven could exist in such hell... Whereupon he gets shot in the head
by
a Japanese sniper.
But the thing is, it is the most cartoon sound of a gun. It's like a Bugs Bunny movie, isn't it? It's like Yosemite Sam, like pew.
It's like bang, ooh. Pew. You know how you used to do when you were kids and you were playing war movies and you'd do a ricochet and you'd go, yeah, nearly got me. And it was like pew.
Yeah.
And then he does... Which is surprising, given he's been shot in the brain. He staggers around a bit, going, "Oh, Struth, stone the crows," and collapses. Whereupon, Bluey Donkin, Grant Taylor, goes completely berserk.
Well, this is when it turns into Rambo.
Yeah, it does. Basically. It's sort of Rambo.
First Blood Part 2.
Mixed with Predator. Yeah. Because he's trying to find this Japanese sniper. And he's wading through the paddy. He's like swimming around. He's hiding in the rushes.
And guess what, listeners? He finds him.
Yeah, weird, isn't it?
It's bizarre. And he drowns him.
Yeah. In a really kind of brutal way.
It's really
though he's been shot like 6 times.
It's really quite nasty, that bit.
But he gets home and marries his Kate, so everything's all right.
Yeah, that's true. So, like, he does come back to her. And I don't know what the moral of this story is at all, apart from...
There is no moral.
Go to war, your mates will die,
but
then you'll be married.
Yeah. Special mention, as Simon says, has to go to... It's got to be one of the most eccentric performances in the history of filmmaking.
What, George Wallace?
George Wallace as the Barber of Tobruk. If you imagine sort of 1920s... Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah, it's like Music Hall.
If those of you are familiar with film, actually, if you've ever watched any Laurel and Hardy, one of their nemesis was James Finlayson. It's easy for you to say.
Blimey.
James Finlayson. Anyway. He had a big moustache and glasses, and he used to do this ridiculous double take where his head would go round and round and round and round, and then his eyes would go huge. This fella does that. He does, like, 3 of those.
But
it's like a triple take.
But he's also taking off Oliver Hardy as well, with the whole brushing of the chests and
oh,
stuff.
Oh, I know.
He's doing all of that.
He's stolen every comedian's bit, and he's basically a barber in a rubbish fallen down hole in Tobruk. And all he does is moan. Well, it's very weird to hear what he moans about. He moans about having to cut hair. He moans about not being at the front. He tries to get to the front, and the sergeant comes over and goes, get back to your barbershop. He's a sort of fat, sweaty fella in an ill-fitting uniform, and he's so obviously the comic turn.
Oh, it's terrible.
But it's so out of place. It's so jarring and weird and just eccentric.
It is weird. It's just like Charles Chauvel's obviously gone like, this bloke's a comic genius. I'm going to give him free rein. He can just make it all up as he goes on. It doesn't matter. He doesn't need a script. He's a genius at work. And that's what you get.
I don't doubt for one minute that in wartime Australia, this man was like the treasure of vaudeville and the music halls. They probably thought he was the funniest thing that ever happened. Well, he's not in this.
No, he's not. He's terrible. And he's also, and some of his gags are involves some of the most racist things I've ever heard in a film.
He has a whole... Do you remember, Simon? He has this whole bit.
Well, his assistant, do you remember?
Well, he gets assisted by an North African fella.
Yeah.
Who he does this pidgin English with to try and get him to sweep up.
Oh, mate. It's
and
awful.
It is probably one of the most unpleasant... Well, I mean, we're saying this with a 21st century eye.
I don't think we are, because we've watched plenty of films made long before this and set, you know, in the chronological history of World War II, and I haven't seen anything as
blatantly racist. And
yeah, I mean, that's all you could say. It is racist, and I can't believe it's still available without being re-censored.
Yeah,
I'm really surprised, actually. Or maybe, you know, at least have a warning at the beginning.
Yeah, like there's a character in here who's so appalling.
Or just like, you know, outdated, absolutely.
Yeah. There's as a sort of handy comparison, the David Niven film that we reviewed and we liked very much, The Way Ahead. Has a very, very young Peter Ustinov playing a cafe owner.
That's
do you remember?
Right. Yeah.
Who is brilliant.
Yeah.
And there's none of this, like, I'm not even going to do it. The
impersonation
of the sort of North African Arabic patois.
Yeah.
He just plays it very sort of normally. He's great. Whereas this, and also it should be pointed out that when they first walk into Tobruk, there's a bunch of Arabs in full, like, Arabian sort of nomad gear who are so obviously white people with boot polish on.
Oh, mate, it's so bad.
It's so bad.
And also, just going back to The Way Ahead,
they look like minstrels. It's shocking.
No, it is shocking. The difference, obviously, being is that The Way Ahead's a good film. Peter Ustinov's a great actor.
This is it.
And
it was directed by somebody with actual talent.
Yeah, and I just think... Well, also, his character was a character.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
He
went from being like a socialist liberal to, I now understand why we have to fight. You know, at least he had a story. He had an arc.
Yeah. Whereas this poor fella just stands there mutely.
He's just a slave.
Well, he is a slave, whilst the quote-unquote comedian does things like putting his foot in a bucket of water, falling over. I mean, for no reason.
And it lasts. It seems an eternity.
Like 15 minutes. All right, you know what? I'm drawing the line under the rats of bloody Tobruk.
Okay, what do you give it out of 5?
Oh, half.
Okay.
No, it is that appalling. It is. There is no redeeming part of this film in any way. You sort of, like I said, you sort of wish the Germans had won.
Just so
the movie ended sooner.
I've got to say, Peter Finch's performance is pretty good.
Yeah, but it is Peter Finch.
But the whole Shakespeare stuff does begin to wane a little bit.
He's dying and he's quoting Shakespeare.
You know,
sod off.
It's extremely heavy-handed. It's badly made. Yeah, there's nothing to redeem it. It's a -2 from me.
Wow! On the so that's even worse than Confessions of a Nazi Spy.
Well, I think it is worse.
Do you?
Yeah. I mean, Confession of a Nazi Spy is a bore fest. But there are a couple of redeeming parts. The whole film, the whole film noir montage, you know, that bit with Edward G. Robinson.
Yeah, I guess Edward G. Robinson is the only redeeming feature of it. Anyway, next, moving on very, very quickly to 1953.
Yeah, this is The Desert Rats.
Oh, thank God.
Directed by the great genre-hopping director Robert Wise.
Now, tell us about Robert Wise.
Well, Robert Wise is just one of those Hollywood, a bit like Robert Aldrich, you know, but on a...
Done it all.
Yeah, he'll do comedy, he'll do musicals. So he's done West Side Story. He did The Sound of Music. He was also an editor prior to that. He edited Citizen Kane, which kind of speaks for itself.
Yeah, I mean, that's not shoddy, is it?
No, exactly. The Sand Pebbles, The Day the Earth Stood Still, Run Silent, Run Deep.
Which we will be covering. Classic. I can't wait for some.
I Want to Live, The Haunting.
I didn't want to live after Ratatabrook.
The Haunting, which is obviously a masterpiece. The Andromeda Strain, which I love. The Hindenburg, and the slightly disappointing and very slow... But I imagine listeners of this podcast love Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Yeah.
President of the Directors Guild of America from 71 to 75.
Wow.
I mean, he's Hollywood royalty.
Yeah.
You know, which I think is fair. That's fair
and
enough.
And talking
to say.
Of royalty, there's a couple of royals in this. Richard Burton, ladies and gents, amazing. And James Mason.
Yeah, absolutely.
James Mason is a little odd. Because they do decide to, the film starts with James Mason, doesn't it? And his German pals running around the desert, and it's all in German without subtitles. So don't, if you're watching this, folks, don't start trying to, you know, add subtitles or whatever to your viewing. There aren't any.
Yeah, it's weird. That is quite strange. But I mean...
And it doesn't do the thing that happens, for instance, which I think it's in The Longest Day, where the German just suddenly stops and everyone speaks English.
Right.
Oh, no, it's not Longest Day, because they speak German all the way through. It's subtitled, isn't it?
Of course it is, yes.
Yeah, of course it is, because they're all actually German actors, not Brits going, you know, there are your papers. I would have been great. I definitely would have worked a lot as a Nazi. Anyway, what, anything else you want to say?
Well, so James Mason is obviously Rommel, and Richard Burton is, well, he arrives at, bizarrely playing a Scot, and I've never quite understood why.
Why? Well, his name's Captain Tammy McRoberts. Yeah. Why didn't they just call him Captain Taffy McDavies?
Oh, my God.
Well, he's Welsh.
Delete. So we're also forgetting about... there's another great performance in the film. We're forgetting about Robert Newton.
Yeah.
From the beginning, right?
Yeah. Come on then.
We've got Burton and his gang into Brook. He's like a field officer, and he has to take control of these bunch of Aussie troops who are untried.
Yeah.
And he's a proper no-nonsense. He's a bastard, basically. He's one of those hard but fair. They all hate him.
Oh, they hate him so much they tried to kill him.
Yeah, but let's not forget that Chips Rafferty is also in this.
Yeah,
and Chips Rafferty in this is called Bluey.
Yeah,
and he kind of like begins to like him and understand Tammy McRoberts, and then Tom Bartlett, played by Robert Newton, who's an alcoholic teacher.
Ex-school teacher of Tammy. Richard Burton's.
Yeah, and Tammy loves him. And all of a sudden you see this completely different side to Burton's character. Yeah. It's just like, I've got to look after this man.
Yeah.
This is a bloke I cared for deeply. He was obviously a very inspirational teacher who just happened to be pissed all the time.
Yeah.
And
now he's pissed all the time.
Yeah, and he's hammered all the time. But, I mean, so Burton tries to, like... make sure he doesn't go in the front line and all this, but he's having none of it. He's there. He said he's been a coward all his life and he wants to see action. along those lines.
Well, the thing you get from him is that... just to backtrack just a little bit. So this film basically opens in the middle of the campaign for the Germans to retake Tobruk. And there is actually the exact same scene in both films where you see generals in a bunker, British generals, going, here's what we're going to do, fellas.
Yeah.
And they have this cunning plan of letting the Germans... So I'm assuming, because it's in both films, this was actually quite a clever ruse that the Brits really... Well, sorry, the Brits.
Well, not. This is the siege, right?
Yes, this is actually the siege. And they've shipped in the Aussies to be sort of fresh replacements for the besieged town. And when we meet them on the dock, they're all lounging around, goofing about, and... Captain Tammy McRoberts, Richard Burton, appears, and he's furious with him. He's not having it.
He's totally, he's an angry young man.
Yeah, and the Aussie, you can tell he gets the Aussies' backs up right away.
Yeah.
And they're all looking at each other going, oh, we've got a right one here, Bluey. But then he hears a bottle fall, and the camera sort of, you know, zooms in on this empty whiskey bottle at the feet of Robert Newton, Tom Bartlett. And I think he even says something like, right, this man's going to be shot. I think he's like threatening actual capital punishment for whoever it is that's dropped this. And then he realizes who it is and he goes, oh, is that you, Tommy? Oh, Tommy. Why are you here? It's a very moving moment, and he basically...
Their relationship's really sweet and really well done. Oh, they're both obviously amazing actors, and they're and it's really well handled.
And the film really takes off when it's just the two of them.
Yeah, it's great.
So basically, they fight off the Germans. Some really great, gripping action stuff footage. As the German tanks roll in.
Oh, man. I mean, this is an action film. It's an action film with a couple of deep parts. But literally, this is a shoot-em-up.
This is what we wanted as kids.
Yeah, this is short trousers, satchel swinging around your head, running down like in Hope and Glory. It's pure action.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about it in a bit, but, you know, in the recent, SAS series by Stephen Knight,
Available, I believe, on Amazon or Netflix.
I think it's iPlayer.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay.
Rogue Heroes or whatever. I mean, yeah. This kind of deals with that too, like the birth of the SAS essentially.
Weirdly, yeah. Because
obviously it's an amalgamation and it's fiction how it's dealt with in this film, but it's all there.
Yeah.
All the secret behind enemy lines. They become raiding commandos, exactly, yeah. And scouts.
Well, because despite being in the front lines, Captain Tammy McRoberts. Such a terrible name.
It's brilliant. I love it.
He actually turns them into a well-drilled, very accomplished professional soldiers. There is one point when the Germans try and break through, his sort of second in command, who is an Aussie, a lieutenant, I believe, he runs out of his foxhole to save a wounded soldier.
Yes.
And for which Richard Burton wants him shot.
Right.
I mean, he probably he court-martials him and sends it in, and even his superior's like, well, I do say, dear boy, it's a bit harsh. I mean, he was just saving another one, and Captain Tammy's going, you can't let them get away with this stuff. They must be stopped.
Yeah, it's all, and he's
shoot him.
He's all top-heavy on the discipline.
Yeah, and it is his old school teacher, Tom Bartlett, that persuades him not to have his second-in-command executed for desertion. And so you see a softening of Captain McRoberts, and you see that poor old Tom is still drunk, and he's probably always going to be drunk in a bit. It's Robert Newton. He's not a fine specimen of a man, is he?
No. It's kind of unbelievable in that aspect. It's all of a sudden, it's just like, there's no way that bloke's sent to the front.
No, he didn't even get through. He certainly didn't even get through the
basic training.
No. He can't even do his uniform up. Anyway, they become they survive the siege of Tobruk. They drive off the Germans. And this is where it actually moves on from the other two films we've seen. So it's now sort of the Allies in North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard Burton's crew has become so successful at raiding at night and taking out German planes and fuel dumps and whatnot that they've sort of been given a green light, haven't they?
Yeah.
To sort of just run around behind enemy lines.
Which is exactly what happens with the birth of the SAS.
Exactly right. So it's sort of stealing from that. And they end up... Oh, what are they trying to blow up? A fuel dump? Or is it... it's fuel for the planes, isn't it? For the German Luftwaffe or something. Or it's an ammunition dump?
I think it's an ammo dump. But we've got, again, a lot's happened between us seeing this movie, which we really apologise about, and it's just been one of those months.
Yeah. It is a while since we watched it. But they go and blow this place up, and they actually come up against quite stiff resistance this time because the Germans are now onto them.
Mm-hmm.
And Captain McRoberts gets captured, and he ends up in a medical tent, absolutely giving a mouthful to the poor little German surgeon.
Oh, to the surgeon, yeah, and also to the Africa Corps troop. That's like assisting.
He's
him.
Ordering them around. He's shouting at them, and I sort of thought, you know what? I bet my granddad would have been like that if he'd ever been.
Was he an officer?
Well, your he was granddad? A regimental sergeant major,
right,
so he would have probably treated them like dirt.
Yeah, so...
which is very what he does, right up until the point where General Rommel walks into the tent, also injured. They both basically got identical injuries.
Now, this
their
is
arms.
Great. So this is, as far as I'm concerned, first time in, like, cinematic history where Michael Mann gets the idea for the coffee... shop sequence in Heat between De Niro and Pacino.
Oh, do you reckon?
So you've got these two guys who are in the background of this film all the time. Well, yeah. One in the background and one's like the main protagonist.
Yeah.
And then they finally meet and you know there's going to be some kind of showdown between
them. Yeah. Yeah, that's... I can see where you're coming because
it is so great. They're on the opposite sides, but they're the same dude.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? They're the soldier's soldier.
And there's a sort of respect between
them. There's a total respect. They're both massively ultra-disciplined soldiers. They both believe in what they're doing is the right thing.
Yeah.
And he, you know, and Rommel talks, it's like he'll be treated as an officer, as a prisoner of war. You know, he'll be safe. And I don't know, I thought that sequence was great. And you don't, you know, Mason's hardly in this film. But when he's in it, it's his. Oh, he just steals completely.
There's no doubt about who is on the screen.
And
is
it's
there?
What? No, he's just mesmerizing, and
so much so that he ended up playing it again.
Well, and I mean, obviously the producers looked at it. It's just like, well, mate, we've got to use him. It's just like, what should we call this one? What was he known as? The Desert Fox. Okay, let's call it
Desert Fox, and it's just him all the time.
Yeah.
Basically, doing the same performance.
Yeah, and it's brilliant.
It's because he has that. When you think of James Mason in... Well, when is this? This is 1953. So, not by much. A couple of years, I reckon. North by Northwest, where he's the baddie. Mm-hmm. James Mason is the bad guy.
Well, but he's such a wonderful villain.
But is that's...
Because I never find him malevolent.
No. He's totally believable, and yet... totally, you get that he's the bad guy, but in a very, very believable way. There's none of this sort of...
There's such similar actors to me.
Well,
you know,
similar generation, I suppose.
But, but I mean, they're both so in charge of their craft, aren't they? You know, Burton and Mason.
Yeah.
And it's the same when Burton would play a villain. I mean, he's a lot more menacing because he's just more of an aggressive personality.
Yeah.
Like when he plays O'Brien in 1984, he's still a very softly spoken villain, but he's bloody terrifying.
Yeah, he's terrifying even where Eagles Dare.
Yeah, he is, as Major Smith.
In the scene that nobody understands, where everyone's tied up
I've rewatched that very recently, and I wanted to phone you, but it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'd had a couple of drinks, but I was just like, oh, I get it.
Oh, did you?
I had a eureka moment.
You woke up the next morning and you couldn't remember.
I do remember. We've just been overthinking it. It's just really badly written.
Well, Foxhole fans, you're not Foxhole fans unless you're a fan of Where Eagles Dare. And so you'll know exactly what scene we're talking about. It's like the double, triple, quadruple cross scene.
It's just badly written by Alistair MacLean.
Even in that, he's terrifying.
Yeah.
Even for the brief moment where you go, oh my God, he's the Nazi.
Oh, he's terrifying throughout that, though.
Yeah.
You know, even when he speaks to Mary Eureka, he's like, take your clothes off.
Broadsword calling Danny Boy.
Right, back to this one.
All right, back to this one. Funnily enough, though, having said all that, Richard Burton did later say that in this film, every line of dialogue sounded as though it had been taken directly from an army training manual.
Okay.
So he obviously wasn't a huge fan. It was basically the last film that he needed to make to get out of his contract with 20th Century Fox.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So he... This is still this weird crossover time, right? Mm. Into the 50s of American filmmaking where you were a contract player.
Yeah.
And you were contracted to a movie studio and you could only make films that movie studio.
And obviously he's a name and he's a star already, but he's not the megastar that he becomes in the early 60s.
Yeah. So
when he's commanding $1 million a movie.
So even when he's in a film which he obviously didn't think was that great and he was just doing to get out of a contract.
Oh, he's great in it.
He's still great in it.
Fair play to him.
Sadly, on a sad note, Robert Newton... playing the drunk schoolmaster Tom Bartlett, very believable as an alcoholic in this film. It was not sort of silly, you know.
Are you telling me it was full method then?
Well, he was sadly quite an alcoholic, and he basically, not long after this film, became unemployable due to his drinking, and he died 3 years later.
Oh, God.
They say from a heart attack, but I think in those days that was basically a generic term they used for anybody who died in a way that you couldn't write in the obit in the Times, you know?
Yeah.
He died of alcoholism, probably, which makes this kind of...
Allegedly.
It makes it kind of sad because it's sort of his last film, and he's so good in it.
He is great.
It ends up, shall we just cut to the chase?
Yes, let's do it.
It ends with, because they are by far the best bunch of soldiers in Tobruk, that they end up being sent out to a remote hill, which has an unobstructed view of the desert, to try and hold off the entire German army.
Oh, with the observation post.
Just long enough for the reinforcements to come through from Egypt, right? So it actually is quite an important thing they've got. And they've been told to last something like, you know, a day. And they're there for 2 weeks. And it's actually, it's a great scene where Richard Burton's in his little sort of foxhole. And he's on his radio basically calling back to base. And he has to make the decision whether or not to pull out. And the general basically says, look, I'll leave it up to you. It's your call. And he's going to pull them out, and he's going to pull them out because he's grown so fond of these soldiers, and they fought so hard on top of this hill, and they're getting wiped out by the sounds of it.
And isn't it Chips Rafferty that talks him round?
Well, no, actually, it's not Chips Rafferty. It's a very moving moment. He goes out to tell everyone to pack up and leave, and he goes, where's Tom? And they go, oh, he's gone down there. And there's one position on this hill that no one lasts longer than a few hours in. It's the forward observation post.
Yeah, that's right.
And he looks down, and there's his old school teacher who's run down there to man it. And so now he can't pull out. And he's realized that, so his old school teacher, who was a bit of a coward, you know, he didn't really want to, you know, he wanted to fight. So he had to, he's done it himself. He's gone run forward. And at that point, a huge barrage comes in. And they think they're done for, and what do they hear in the distance? It's the best thing in any war film, and it's in so many war films. If you're desperately clinging on for reinforcements, what do you hear ringing through the distance? Bagpipes. What are you laughing at? Because the Scots are here, the reinforcements are through, and they have saved the day. And it's great, and they do survive, and they're relieved, and... Hold until relieved.
And
what's that from?
Longest Day.
Yes.
And
they get saved by bagpipes as well.
That's right, yeah. Well, they don't get saved, do they? He has to hold it for...
Yes, but the reinforcements...
Mountbatten. Mountbatten's lot, right?
Yeah, are the commandos, but they have that fella on the bagpipes.
That's
who,
right.
Weirdly, at the beginning, when they first jump on the beach and the bagpipes start Sean Connery playing an Irishman for some reason going, Sean, look at the hear that! Oh, what a noise that is! If I don't shoot them myself before the end of the day.
That's what he says, because they're both Irish, aren't they? I can't remember the other two.
The other one's a right old Cockney geezer.
But Sean Connery turns around and he's like, oh, that's terrible. And he goes like, it takes an Irishman to really play the pipes. He must have gone like, really, do I have to say that?
Another example in a long career of Sean Connery weirdly not playing Scottish people when he should have been.
Yeah, thickest Scottish accent ever.
Because he never does anything else. Yeah, it's always Scottish.
So he's played an Irishman, a Russian, with this.
Well, the worst one's in Highlander, a film about Scottish warriors where he plays
Spaniard.
A Spanish swordsman.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's called like Don Eduardo or something. and he's more Scottish than that than in anything.
Yeah, true.
God bless him.
That is very...
Anyway.
Very strange career move.
So, a cracking good film, don't you think?
Well, obviously, and this is a very old-fashioned, great war movie.
It's a romp. We've got commando raids. We've got epic tank battles.
This is the kind of movie you want to come on at, like, 3 p.m. on a wintry afternoon.
Or Boxing Day.
Yeah, yeah. It's a cracker. It's an absolute cracker.
So we highly recommend that all Foxhole fans watch this, because this is basically the film, the sort of film that Simon and I were referring to when we were like, we really love war films.
Yeah. It's
a classic.
It's a boy's own adventure completely.
Yeah.
And so what do you give that out of 5?
Oh, well. See, now this is where we're in trouble. We almost need a different scale here, Simon, because if you've got things like
King's Choice,
or you've got our favourite Polish one,
Westerplatte,
you know, those were really powerful, well-made films.
Yeah, but we're going to be watching, and we already have, but we are going to be watching a lot of films. So I think you're allowed... You're allowed to grade them depending on mood, what you think of... It's not like... For instance, in my world,
yes.
Where Eagles Dare and yes. The Dirty Dozen yep. get 5 out of 5.
Every time.
But so does Apocalypse Now. So does The Thin Red Line.
Okay, I'm with you. I'm with you. Okay. Yeah, all right, then. So then I'm going to have to go with 4.5, I think.
Okay, fair enough. I'll do the same. 4.5.
Yeah, it's the classic black and white war movie action, and it's stars.
Yeah, it just happens to have 3 great actors in it as well, and 2 especially.
Yeah, so highly recommend. Weirdly enough, you can't see it. You got to go on YouTube.
I've got it on DVD.
We watched it on DVD, that's right.
It's available on DVD, and you can rent it on YouTube. I don't think it's on any other platform.
No, it's not. Neither of these are. Well, obviously, Rats of Tobruk aren't on anything, as is quite right, because it's shocking.
Was that one that you had to rent from YouTube, or was it just on there for free?
No, we had to rent it from YouTube, wow. Which I feel kind of...
Let's get a lawyer involved. Let's get a lawyer
involved
and get our $1.99 back.
I don't want to get my 2 hours back.
That's true.
That's 2 hours of my precious life gone. Well,
that's got to be worth double $1.99. Yeah, so go and see that if you can.
Now then.
But hold on. Ooh. If for some reason you can't get a hold of it, I will gladly send you my copy. But you have to answer our quiz question right at the end of the show.
If you can remember as far back as our last podcast, we had a little competition, didn't we?
Oh, yes, for Commando.
And we had a question with regards to the film Tobruk. And the question was what was the mythical creature of a Polish and Jewish origin that was supposed to have protected the citizens of Prague. And the answer, correct answer, was a golem.
The golem.
The golem. And Heather Smith got that right.
Nice one, Heather Smith.
Well done, Heather. So we now have, and you will be getting that in the post in probably about the next 18 months.
Have you not sent it yet? Sorry, Heather.
It's coming, don't worry.
The secretary at Foxhole Towers is on leave.
Look, I wasn't going to send it all that way whilst our posties are on strike.
Fair enough.
Who we fully support and are right behind, but basically nothing's open in this country anymore. It's broken. It worked better during the Blitz.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, well done, Heather. So that means we've now got two copies of Commando left to be won.
Did she say which one she wanted?
No, it's going to be a surprise.
Okay, because it's either the Desert War.
Right. There was a sort of Burma one.
The Burma one, which is a great one because it's got death by saltwater crocodiles.
Yeah.
Which is very, very strange. And it all gets a bit 2000 AD.
And then there's the one about... There's the
oh,
one
the North
about
Sea the, one.
No, it's not North Sea. It's the London Estuary, remember? It's the lookout posts off Essex.
Oh, yes. Okay.
So you'll be getting one of those rip-roaring yarns, Heather. But we've got to... we're going to have another competition.
We are.
So, ladies and gents, to win another one of our supremely sought-after copies of Commando...
No! No, it's to win the Desert Rats on DVD.
Oh, what about another copy of Commando?
Well, all right, but...
Yeah, because we've got to get rid of them.
I know, but I said, at the end of the show, if you can't find a place to watch Desert Rats, I'll send you my copy as long as you answer the quiz question correctly.
Oh, okay. Here's Simon's question to win his well-worn copy of the Desert Rats of DVD. Now, remember, folks, we have a lot of international listeners. If you're not... from the UK, you probably can't answer this question because you're not going to be able to watch this unless you've got one of those clever DVDs that plays all regions.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, who even has a DVD player apart from us?
Really?
Yeah, hardly anyone uses them anymore. There's no use for them, is there?
So what kind of prize is that?
Well, I don't know. It's just a gift, isn't it?
All right. Here it is. Here's our question for this not sought-after copy. Or that you can only play if you're in England one has a DVD player.
Not only that, I got it in a box set of war films, so it's one of those really slim ones. It's not even like a proper box one.
Oh, we're really pushing out the boat here at Foxhall Towers. Wow. God, you must be so grateful we're even on the air, dear listeners, that we're offering this kind of... Didn't he do well? Anyway, oh my Lord. How about this? We'll offer that. And another copy of Commando, okay. Just to beef up the prize. Okay. Otherwise, it's just shocking. Christ almighty. That's like in the old days of British game shows on TV. Like 3-2-1. What was it? Bullseye. Bullseye. The prizes on Bullseye were shocking. You'd literally win like... There you go, you've won £15. And he would literally count it out in fivers. That was there. Five, that's 10, that's 15.
So he's
and
not
you're
a Cockney.
This week's winner.
He's not a Cockney, it's Jim Bullimore. It's Jim
Bullimore. Oh, that's right, he's up north, isn't he? He goes, yeah. You won yourself £15.
Buy yourself a house.
Yeah. We're not that bad. Or the blankety blank checkbook and pen.
Oh, I'd always wanted
or
one of them.
Or Sweepy the Bin. What was Sweepy the Bin?
Dusty Bin. Dusty Bin.
God, help
British
me.
TV in the 80s was magic.
Yeah. Anyway, we're better than that, Simon. So to win... Jesus, this is taking forever. To win Simon's well-worn copy of The Desert Rats and one of our amazing copies of Commando... Answer this question. There are a lot of answers to this, so we're going to go with whoever comes in first. We've got two blueies in two different films. We have the same actor, Chips Rafferty, in both, and we have James Mason, who played Rommel twice.
Twice, yeah.
Dear listeners, name an actor that played the same part twice in two different films.
And you can't say someone from a series like Sean Connery playing James Bond.
Yeah, it can't be the same character in the same series of films. It has to be two completely different films, like The Desert Fox and The Desert Rats. Something like that. There are lots of instances, modern and old, and the first one to come in with the correct answer wins the prize. Christ almighty, that took forever. Anyway, the exciting news, Simon, is now that...
It's the end of the show.
Yeah, it's every listener's favourite bit where they go, thank God that's over. Talk about wasting lives. Anyway, we've been saying it for about a year, but it's finally come. Do you know what time it is, Simon?
It's time for the start of the Eastern Front.
Oh, the Eastern Front, ladies and gents.
We are going to be visiting Belarus and the Brest Fortress
in the amazing
Fortress Brilliant. Of War.
Oh, Fortress of War.
AKA the Brest Fortress.
Oh,
which
what
is
a film!
A Russian-Belarusian co-production. Obviously, this has come at a very strange time for us to be talking about a film which celebrates heroism of the Belarus and
the Russian
and the Russians. But as we said previously, we can't completely wipe out and do a revisionist history of World War II. We can't pretend that the Allies would have won World War II
without the Russians,
without the Soviet Union.
Sorry. So, yeah, and that's the other thing is the difference here is what's going on in Ukraine right now is Russia, the Russian Federation, in fact. And what was happening in the Second World War was the Soviet Union, or at least that's our excuse.
It's gonna, and I'm afraid it's an excuse that, whether you agree with it or not, we think is legitimate. And I'm sure most of our listeners will. I'm sure all of our listeners will. You can't do a chronological history of World War II without talking about the Soviet Red Army.
Yeah,
it's impossible.
Because you've
got the Brest Fortress, which is the start of the Russians' involvement against Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you have the Battle of the Kursk. You'll have Leningrad, Stalingrad.
Oh.
It's these Sevastopol, gargantuan battles which involve the Soviet Red Army and the Soviet Navy. So,
epic films we've got coming up as well, some of which are brilliant.
Well, I think the Brest Fortress is brilliant.
It is. It is an absolutely stonkingly good film. The German film Stalingrad, which seen from the German side is endlessly horrible and depressing and awful, but it's very rare that you see that side portrayed in such an honest way. We've got Hollywood visions of it in things like Enemy at the Gates.
Yeah.
With Jude Law as the famous Russian sniper.
Yep. Well, it's bizarre, isn't it? So Enemy at the Gates is based on a true Battle of Stalingrad between a German marksman, which is Ed Harris in that movie.
Which is great.
Yeah. Anyway, that's where we are now. I hope you understand. We'd be a lot more comfortable doing it if Russia wasn't at war with Ukraine. But
that's the way it is.
We did take a sabbatical for quite a long time, knowing that it wasn't the right time to do it.
Yeah.
But we can't move on now.
Without
covering it. Because we can't suddenly say, well, we're going to jump to Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
You know, we've got to do it. So I hope you understand, and I hope you join us.
And you will join us, because there's some cracking good films coming up. I can promise you that. There may be a sneaky little Foxhole special episode coming out, which might just be me. Simon can join me if he wants, but he may not fancy it, which is just to set up the German invasion of the Soviet Union, Operation Barbarossa. It's kind of a huge topic, and there's no one single film that covers it sort of comprehensively. You see bits of it, like the battle for the Brest Fortress. But this was like the largest land invasion in the history of war, and there was a lot going on. So I'm thinking of doing just maybe a 15 or 20 minute history lesson to cover that in the very near future before we start watching the films. Otherwise, those episodes are just going to be really long and just all history.
Okay.
So, on that note, on that bombshell, dear listeners, you've been listening to
The Foxhole Companion.